Hello, everyone. Welcome to this LSE online event, The Paradox Between Human Rights and Security Politics, hosted by the European Institute. My name is Jennifer Jackson Priest. I'm Associate Professor in Nationalism with a joint appointment in both LSE's European Institute and also the Department of International Relations. I'm delighted to be chairing this event today and very pleased to welcome our panel. We are joined by Professor Daniela Harhus, who is a professor of human rights law at the University of Applied Sciences in Düsseldorf. Additionally, Daniela has worked abroad at UNESCO in Paris and also at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. We're also very pleased to have with us Gies de Vries, who is a visiting senior fellow at the LSE European Institute and a former State Secretary of the Interior in the government of the Netherlands. From 2004 to 2007, Gies served as the European Union's first counterterrorism coordinator. For those of you who are Twitter users, please note the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSESecurity. This online event is being recorded and hopefully it will be made available as a podcast, fingers crossed, assuming there are no technical difficulties. As usual, there will be an opportunity for the audience to put questions to the panel. To submit your questions, please use the question and answer feature at the bottom of your screen. Questions will be submitted to myself, and I will pose as many as possible to the speaker. It would be great if you can also let us know your name and your affiliation so I know how to address you when I call upon the question and share it with our panelists. I am now delighted to hand over to Professor Harhus for her presentation. Daniela, it's all yours.
Thank you very much. A warm welcome from my side and a big thank you for the invitation here. I'm really glad to talk to you about this important topic, and I'm really glad to talk to this important topic with Gies and Jennifer today, and I'm really looking forward. So let's start with my short presentation. Before our event here, I gave Stuart Brown, the managing editor of LSE's European Politics and Policy, an interview about human rights and security politics, and he asked me an excellent question, and here it is. Security and human rights issues are closely related, but there is occasionally a lack of clarity in how academics approach the two topics. How can we make better sense of the links between security and human rights? This was his question. And my answer was, security must aim to protect human rights. Security can't be achieved by the violation of human rights. Does this claim reflect the political reality? Definitely not. However, this should not prevent us as academics from looking at security challenges from exactly this perspective. If we talk about security politics in our lectures, we always have to discuss the human rights aspect of the taken measures, and are the measures protecting human rights, and are the measures itself violating human rights? I will give you now in the next 20 minutes five examples concerning the paradox between human rights and security. My first example will be the work of intelligence services. My second one will be the fight against terrorism. I will be shorter here because I'm sure Gies will give us some very interesting insights later on from his work from the European Union. My third example is experts of surveillance technology. My fourth example will be hate crime and social media. And my fifth example, migration. And now during my following elaborations, please keep in mind the two questions regarding my five examples for security politics. First, are the measures protecting human rights? And second, are the measures itself violating human rights? Let's start with my first case study, the work of intelligence services. The task of intelligence agencies is to collect information, analyze it, and give it to their government. With this advance in information, the respective government should be enabled to have a better understanding of the current security challenges and take the right decisions to protect their country and their people. when I had once a conversations with a bunch of German intelligence officers during my time at the German Chancellery, I told them, you know, the aim of your work is to protect human rights. And they were first astonished. We are not Amnesty International. No, you're not, but this is the aim of your work. And finally, they agreed, but they were astonished. The measures of intelligence agencies taken via OSINT, open source intelligence, HUMINT, human intelligence, SIGINT, signal intelligence, GEOINT, geospatial intelligence, and now they are also working on SOCMINT, social media intelligence, they have the aim to protect the fundamental rights and security in the respective country. I'm talking now about Western intelligence services, not services from Belarus, China, or Saudi Arabia. Back to our two core questions. The first one, are the measures of Western intelligence services protecting human rights? Yes and no, they are protecting the human rights of the inhabitants of the respective country. Or to put it in a quotation I found here from Gies de Vries, my dear colleague, you can't get closer to the heart of national sovereignty than national security and intelligence services. What is the answer to our second question? Are the measures itself violating human rights? So are the measures of intelligence services violating human rights? Shortly and simple, yes. If the NSA, for example, is spying on the whole communication of Germany, they are violating our right for privacy. But has the NSA already prevented terrorist attacks in Germany with this information and protected the right to live of German people? Yes, they have too. And here we have a huge paradox between human rights and security politics. The violation of human rights can lead to the protection of human rights. If this is justified, I would like to discuss with you later on. And a spoiler for the discussion later on, I'm skeptical towards the work of intelligence services. So the terrorism example leads to the next big topic between human rights and security politics, the fight against terrorism. The last big heads of the Hydra named Islamistic motivated terrorism were Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State. A bunch of measures led to the success that these organizations don't play that prominent role anymore than they had in former times. But what was the most effective measure against these organizations? What do you think? What would you think? Sanctions list, counter-propaganda? In the end, it were targeted killings committed, for example, via drones with the help of a lot of intelligence services. And were these measures protecting human rights? Yes, the lives of people in Western countries. And were the measures itself violating human rights? Our second question, definitely they were. Even if you are in favor of the death penalty is only allowed according to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 6, Paragraph 2. This penalty can only be carried out pursuant to the final judgment rendered by a competent court. There was no trial and no judgment by a competent court before the drones flew to Afghanistan or Syria. This is the first violation of human rights. The second one is the killing of innocent people around the killed terrorist, or euphemistically referred to as collateral damages. And another example in the fight against terrorism is the use of torture. According to Article 7 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, torture is prohibited in times of peace, and according to Article 3 of all the Geneva Conventions, it's also prohibited in times of war. Amnesty International France had once a very intensive campaign. You could see the face of an obviously mistreated Dalai Lama saying, "Every man who hasn't bought a watch from Rolex in his life botched his life." And the next sentence was, "Under torture, anyone would say anything." Nevertheless, torture was and is a tool against terrorism. And one of the argumentations is, in torturing a few, it's possible to save many. Obviously, these measures are completely contrary to human rights and not justifiable, in my opinion. And who, by the way, is talking about Guantanamo today? It's still existing. And nobody cares. Let's come to our third example. Export of surveillance technology. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace published a very interesting index, the Artificial Intelligence Global Surveillance Index. The definition of artificial intelligence for the study is, artificial intelligence is not a specific technology. The goal of artificial intelligence is to make machines intelligent by automating or replicating behavior that enables an entity to function appropriately and with foresight in its environment. And the index compiles empirical data on the use of artificial intelligence surveillance technology in 176 countries around the world. It does not distinguish between legitimate and unlawful uses of this surveillance technology. Rather, the purpose of the research was to show how new surveillance capabilities are transforming the ability of governments to monitor and track individuals or systems. Key findings of the studies, amongst other findings, were artificial intelligence surveillance technology is spreading at a faster rate to a wider range of countries than experts have commonly understood. At least 75 countries globally are using actively these technologies for surveillance purposes. And this includes smart city, safe city platforms, facial recognition systems, and smart policing. Who is the major driver for this form of intelligence surveillance systems? China. What are the companies from China here? You name it, Huawei, Hikvision, Dahua, CTE. They supply surveillance technology in 63 countries. Huawei alone is responsible for providing this technology to at least 50 countries worldwide. But also US companies are active in the space. Here the firms are IBM, Palantir, Cisco. They supply this technology to 32 countries. And we have also other countries that are active here, like France, Germany, Israel, and Japan. And what is the problem? Democracies are not taking adequate steps to monitor and control the spread of sophisticated technology linked to a range of violations here. Interesting in the study was also that liberal democracies are the major users of this artificial intelligence surveillance. This does not mean that they abuse it, but they use it. Governments in autocratic and semi-autocratic countries are more prone to abuse this technology than governments in liberal democracies, concerning to the study. And some autocratic governments, for example, China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, are exploiting this technology for mass surveillance purposes. Let's stay for a while with Saudi Arabia. My home country, Germany, has an intensive history in exporting military and surveillance goods to Saudi Arabia. We're very good at this. Only the war in Yemen and the humanitarian catastrophe here and the murdering of Jamal Khashoggi led the German government to the decision not to export any goods until the end of this year to Saudi Arabia. We will see what will come. The argumentation against export bans is often the same. With an export ban, the economy is ruined. If we don't export, someone else will. So I'm interested here in the opinions of the students and our discussion later on. And another example for the misuse of surveillance technology is the so-called social credit system in China. Social, moral, and financial behavior of China citizens and companies will be monitored, followed by rewards and punishments. This is a massive undermining of human rights. We can discuss later on. Let's come to my fourth example, hate crime on social media. Let's go back in times and history a little bit. At the Agora, the marketplace and speaking area of the Greek antiquity, it was the right of every individual, or to be precise, of every male individual with full civil rights, to express their own opinion and point of view, as well as making proposals to the assembly. This right existed until the Roman Republic and received more and more restrictions in the course of Christianization. After all, utterances should not come under the suspicion of blasphemy. The Middle Age was the darkest time for the freedom of opinions, and it was completely under the surveillance of the Church. With the Enlightenment, freedom of opinion was rediscovered and finally written down in 1789 in the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. In Article 11, it was formulated: the free communication of ideas and of opinions is one of the most precious rights of man. It took then until the 20th century until freedom of opinions was enshrined in legally binding human rights documents like the European Convention or the African Convention on Human Rights, and on the international level on the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights. Only the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights should bring the right for freedom of opinion to a certain universal extent. That's so important for human rights because it's not humanly, it's not legally binding. It's difficult to have a good argumentation with this. Article 19 of this covenant protects the freedom of opinion. Now we have a new agora: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you name it. This led to a democratization of the possibility to spread opinions, but also the anonymity of social media fake names and the circumstance that news and opinions can so easily be published led also to a spread of alternative facts and even worse, hate crime. So the question is, are human rights, and specifically Article 19 of this international covenant in this field, still the correct legal yardstick? Human rights were developed to protect the individual, a group, against the state. They were not developed to protect a private person from a private person or a private company. But human rights violations take exactly place in this sector. In 2018, Amnesty International, for example, published a study concerning violence and hostilities against women on social media platforms with the title Toxic Twitter, a Toxic Place for Women. And they wrote down: for many women, Twitter is a platform where violence and abuse against them flourishes, often with little accountability. As a company, Twitter is failing in its responsibility to protect women's rights online by inadequately investigating and responding to reports of violence and abuse in a transparent manner. The violence and abuse many women experience on Twitter has a detrimental effect on the right to express themselves equally, freely, and without fear. Or we take the horrifying murdering of Samuel Paty last week. Part of the hate started on social media platforms. So we have a huge challenge for security politics here and a huge violation of human rights. So, are human rights still a tool for legal protection against violation like hate speech? In Germany, we don't have a problem that the state sets the legal framework and obliges tech firms like Facebook to investigate hate crime. If this is really effective, would be another discussion. In other states, like the United States or Great Britain, there is a big mistrust against state intervention. If the solution is created by a state or the tech firms themselves, is all the same as long as it is effective. But the euphoria for the freedom of the internet concerning human rights violations should be over. We need rules for the game. And this is a task for security politics. Exclusion, hate and violence endanger the society which security politics is trying to protect. And so we have the situation here that security politics affects human rights, but that security policy must also protect human rights. The question remains to what extent human rights, such as freedom of expression, can be restricted because we can't create new human rights violations here. Now I come to my last example, migration, or the question of refugees. At the end of 2019, at least 79.5 million people around the world were forced to flee their homes, states the UN Refugee Agency in its annual report. This is 1% of the world population. Since 2010, the number of refugees has doubled. Most of them came from Syria, Venezuela, Afghanistan, South Sudan, and Myanmar. But also other places were hotspots for humanitarian crises, including people forced to flee their homes, hunger in East Africa and Yemen, fights in Iraq, in the Central African Republic, the Republic of Burundi, or in Ukraine. The treatment of refugees is, in my concern, a question of human rights. But for politicians, it is realistically also a question of security politics. Therefore, for example, exists in the European Union a hybrid organization, the European Border and Coast Guard Agency, better known as Frontex. On their website, you can read their vision. It is the European area of freedom, security, and peace. And their mission is, together with the member states, we ensure safe and well-functioning external borders, providing security. And what is the tool to guarantee it? Surveillance technology, as we have already talked about in my example 3 in this short lecture. Or to put it in the words of Frontex, to help identify migratory patterns as well as trends in cross-border criminal activities, Frontex analysis data related to the situation at and beyond European Union's external borders. As the European Union is not able to reform the refugee politics by installing, for example, a scheme to distribute asylum seekers across the European Union, European Union's migration politics became a part of European Union's security politics. You can see this in an organization like Frontex or in programs like the Border Management Program for the Maghreb region. This program's aim is to mitigate vulnerabilities arising from irregular migration and to combat irregular migration. And if I come back here to my 2 questions from the beginning, are the measures protecting human rights? Are the measures of the European Union protecting human rights? They intend to. And my 2nd question, are the measures itself violating human rights? At first sight, not, but if you examine the closing of normal refugee routes to fight against illegal migration with the European Union programs, and you force people to take more dangerous routes, you just throw the hot potato, and in this case, endangering the lives of people at another place. So there's one possible solution to combine security politics and human rights in order not to force people to leave their home. A well-balanced mixture of investigating in the local economy and a development policy that fosters peace and gives people a secure home, shortly give people a normal perspective for living. So, if both security politics and human rights politics learn to work together, we will be able to get better solutions for current problems and challenges to come. So thank you for your attention, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much, Daniela. That was a fascinating opening intervention. And I'd now like to bring Gies into the conversation. Gies, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer. And thank you, Daniela, for that wonderfully rich and very elegant presentation in which you very clearly sketched the apparent dilemma of having to choose between security and human rights. Indeed, many politicians, and particularly the popular press, have a tendency of suggesting that there is a binary choice between the two, that we cannot have one and the other, but we must choose between security and human rights. I would like to question that choice, and I very much hope that the students who are taking part in this event we'll look at that tension and at the possibility of combining these two in their own research. I'd like to build on Daniela's presentation by zooming in on one of her 5 areas, counterterrorism, because I have some practical experience in that area. I'd like to discuss the following dimensions. First, the effect that well-intentioned counterterrorism is having on civil space in countries under authoritarian governments. Secondly, as Daniela has also mentioned, the risk of torture being used in the fight against terrorism. Thirdly, I'd like to talk a little bit about the right to privacy that we should all enjoy. Fourthly, I'd like to talk a little bit about freedom of expression. And I'd like to conclude briefly with perhaps one or two remarks on accountability. But perhaps to start, it's important to underline that the fight against terrorism is a fight to protect fundamental human rights. The teacher, Samuel Paty, who was killed this week, had his life cut short, which is the most egregious violation of human rights you can imagine, a violation of the right to life. Counterterrorism protects that right. When the terrorists attacked the Twin Towers in New York in 2011, they committed not just any human rights violation, but arguably they committed a crime against humanity. So counterterrorism is about protecting human rights. But how we go about protecting against terrorism is just as important in terms of protecting human rights. The first risk that we have seen emerging, particularly since 9/11, is that authoritarian governments have seized on the argument that the world needs to act against terrorism by suppressing legitimate criticism. Freedom of speech in many countries, civil space in a country like Turkey, in Egypt, in Russia, has been shut down under the pretext of counterterrorism. Here it's important to focus, I think, as Western countries on two priorities. First, getting third countries to accept that laws must be sufficiently predictable and clear. That means avoiding vague formulations, which unfortunately blithe these counterterrorism laws in Turkey and elsewhere. Laws must be predictable. And secondly, they must be proportional. Disproportionate application turns into a violation of human rights. What about the risk of torture? As Daniela mentioned, there is this argument, you may have come across it in academic circles as well, of the smoking gun, the idea that torture must be used to prevent an imminent attack, the so-called ticking time bomb scenario. Beware. This is a red herring. It is an unacceptable argument for three reasons. Torture is illegal under international law. Torture is immoral, and torture is counterproductive as a tactic of counterterrorism. It is illegal in two respects. Governments are obliged not to use torture. The prohibition of torture is non-derogable, even under conditions of war. But secondly, governments are under the obligation to act positively to protect against this evil. So it's illegal under all circumstances. It is also profoundly immoral. The UN, former UN rapporteur on terrorism, Manfred Novak, called this the de facto dehumanization of humans. One cannot defend humans by dehumanizing them. And thirdly, it's counterproductive. In my time as counterterrorism coordinator, there was the problem that the United States practiced illegal interrogation techniques in the Iraqi prison of Abu Ghraib that severely damaged the image of the United States as a defender of human rights, as did Guantanamo. There are still around 40 people in detention without trial in Guantanamo. And there's, of course, the case of the renditions of suspects to countries where they were at risk of being tortured. It took ultimately the European Court of Human Rights to finally prove that even European countries like Poland, Romania, the former Republic of Macedonia and Lithuania had been complicit in these activities. The use of those techniques in the fight against terrorism deeply damages the credibility of those who claim to protect human rights against terrorism. We should guard against that absolutely. The third point is the right to privacy. Again, often politicians suggest that we could trade in a little bit of protection of privacy to get a lot more security. But privacy is a fundamental right. It protects us as individuals from the overweening power of the state. And that is crucial, as many countries experience. So I'm actually quite pleased to have seen that the European Court of Justice, in a series of rulings, has protected privacy also in the fight against terrorism in terms of certain laws that it has declared invalid. That includes even a European Union directive. The latest ruling came only a few months ago against practices by Belgium, the United Kingdom, and France. I mention this also with a view to Brexit, because the European Court of Justice has also said that the right to privacy must be protected when EU countries exchange information with non-European countries, such as the United States. And two subsequent agreements between the EU and the United States have been struck down by the court precisely because the court said American protection of privacy is not equivalent to the protection of privacy that European citizens enjoy in Europe, and therefore these data may not be exchanged. When the United Kingdom leaves, finally, the European Union, we'll see under what circumstances, and it is therefore a third country, it will have to take account of these rulings of the European Court of Justice, because no EU partner can ignore those rulings. Then there is the question of freedom of expression. The key question here is, do we wish counterterrorism to protect solely against the risk of ongoing or imminent attack? Or do we want counterterrorism legislation also to apply to extremist thinking that may not necessarily morph into participation in or direct support for violence? Where to draw the line? The British Prevent Strategy defines non-violent extremism, and I quote, as vocal or active opposition to fundamental British values, including democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty, and mutual respect and tolerance of different faiths and beliefs. Schools, universities, even doctors, among others, are obliged to refer individuals that hold such views to the authorities. I'm not sure that that is the best way to tackle the issue. Let me quote Professor Louise Richardson, the Vice Chancellor of Oxford University and a well-known expert on terrorism, who said that if Oxford University would refer everyone, quote, we would have to burn all our books by Plato and refer half our philosophy department who questioned these matters, end of quote. I would respectfully suggest that counterterrorism should counter violent extremism and not views with which we can reasonably disagree. Last but not least, if we want counterterrorism to protect the liberties of all, we also have to make sure that there are sufficient checks and balances to keep the different institutions on the straight and narrow. This is an area that needs work. I mentioned the case of the European countries that were complicit in illegal renditions. None of their parliaments put a halt to that. The House of Commons has an Intelligence and Security Committee that has done some extraordinarily important work in publishing, for example, two reports in 2018. Documenting British complicity with human rights violations. But it had to cut its research and its investigation short because it could not get sufficient collaboration from the government, including access to key intelligence officials. National parliaments in Europe do not have a stellar record in holding the authorities to account in the fight against terrorism. The courts have done a better job. But we cannot leave it to the courts. civil society and academia equally have to play a part. Again, terrorism is a violation of human rights. But to make sure that counter-terrorism defends human rights and doesn't sacrifice them along the way, it is important for sufficient accountability to be in place, both in terms of parliamentary control and in terms of judicial control and control by civil society. Thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. Well, before we open to the general audience for questions and answers, I'd like to give Daniela a chance to reply to what Gies has just said. And I'm going to be naughty and add a question of my own into the mix. I agree very much with the thrust of both of your comments. As somebody from an IR perspective, when I think of human rights, I usually fall back on R.J. Vincent's writing, his classic treatise on human rights and international relations. And he, in that book, puts forward what he calls the possession paradox as being the cornerstone, in effect, of all controversy around human rights and international relations. And I suspect it is, again, underlying exactly what you've been discussing, Daniela. This is the great irony, of course, that although human rights are meant to be vested in all human beings and universal, in fact, nobody can possess them unless states are prepared to recognize and respect them. And as a result, of course, we have a very uneven practice on human rights. And effectively, what we wind up with is a situation where the rights of some national citizens, not even necessarily all national citizens, get respected, and not necessarily all of the time. My question, to add to what Gies has already said, is really to invite you to perhaps say a little bit more on populism, which seems to be underpinning an awful lot of your cases that you signaled for us, but you didn't in fact directly address it. And my own sense, and certainly I'm suspecting Gies may well agree with me since he brought up Brexit, I mean, this adds another problem to all of these conversations, doesn't it? Because that shift towards populism makes the tendency, of course, for national security to take precedence even stronger. And I think that we can see then, of course, creating even more controversy around issues having to do with human rights and security and the balance that needs to be struck between them, certainly in and around Brexit. But now, Daniela, I turn back to you and look forward to hearing your reply.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with Gies, what he said, especially also the avoiding of vague formulations in laws, because that's a problem, especially now in counterterrorism, that counterterrorism laws are used against the opposition. Yeah, so everybody says, oh, we are against terrorism like Turkey, like Russia. We are doing the same like you in Great Britain and USA and Germany, but they are using it against the own opposition. And that's a big dilemma, and is also miscrediting the whole counter-processing, because the laws are not predictable anymore, they are imprecise, and this is a thing we must change. And here's also a clue word, the laws. As you pointed out, Jennifer, the problem of populism. We have, for example, the problem in Germany that there is a, how can I call it, a human rights shopping, yeah? Every party in a discussion, for example, also in the anti-corona demonstrations, we have mass demonstrations in Germany, they pick just one fundamental right. They pick just one human right and say, yeah, we are protecting this right now. So they are shopping. Yeah. And this is also a problem of the misunderstanding of human rights and fundamental rights. It is a law. It was installed a long time ago to protect the citizen against the state. It's not a law somebody can take and say, I'm protecting it now against another citizen, because this is another thing. If you take it on a normative level, that I think the idea of freedom of opinion is good, we have to work for it, but they are going on a higher level, the populists, they take the fundamental rights, they take the constitution, they take the human rights declaration, say, it's ours, we are defending it now. And so we have a really weird discussion here, because they are discussing from a weird background. They haven't understood the concept of human rights. But if you discuss on this level, even if you're not on the populist level, hey, what do you want? I'm just defending my fundamental rights here. But they have misunderstood the fundamental rights. And I think this is at the moment a huge crisis in new interpretation, and in this case, I have to say, a misinterpretation. There's always room for interpretation, but it's a huge misinterpretation, and the populists are doing a good, not really good job here, unfortunately, right at this moment.
Could I perhaps just follow up, Jennifer, because I think what you asked, I think it's very important, this question of populism, because it ties in with the use of language by politicians and opinion leaders. In recent years, there has been an increasing tendency for public debate to become less civil. There is a degree of demonization often of people with whom certain people disagree. In my own country, the Netherlands, we have cases like Geert Wilders and Thierry Baudet, who leave no stone unturned to suggest that Muslims are somehow ipso facto a security risk. That type of demonizing of part of our society is a populist tool. It is used by politicians to attract votes, but it also creates a rift in society which is very, very difficult to heal. In the fight against terrorism, what matters is isolating the few extremists that are prepared to use or support the use of violence. The overwhelming majority of Muslims wouldn't dream of supporting this, but are at risk of being tarred with the same brush. But the same thing applies when we look at the other side. It's very interesting to see the rise of right-wing violence in Europe at the moment. Is causality the same as coincidence? No. So we cannot prove, I guess, that the increasingly violent language used by some politicians and opinion leaders is triggering this type of violence. But it is clear that a lot of right-wing extremists derive support from what they take to be President Trump's support for right-wing groups. No doubt President Trump does not intend such abuse of his words, but it's happening. That's dangerous. In the United States, right-wing violence has in recent years been responsible for more killings than Islamist violence. We underestimate that tendency, and it's part of the populist drift that we should be very, very careful to watch.
Yes, absolutely. We had an earlier panel just a couple of weeks ago on Black Lives Matter, which made a very similar point, said, do all lives matter? Well, unfortunately, of course, at this point in time, not all lives matter equally. And again, very powerful interventions. I would now like to give an opportunity to the audience to ask some questions. So I'm going to take a couple and then I'll come back to the panel for their reflections and have a bit more of an exchange between the two of you. I have a question from Christina, who is an LSE student from Portugal. And this question is directed to you, Daniela. Christina asks, how can the EU manage effectively a refugee crisis at its borders while still respecting human rights norms at the same time? So an example there for us to think about. Equally, we have a question for you, Gies, and also indeed to the wider panel. If it is your belief that extremist thinking should not be referred to counterterrorism agencies, would you apply the same to hate speech? And along those lines, to what extent does speech influence actions in terms of extremism? And this is from Pradnia, who is a year 12 student in the sixth form here in the UK. Over to you both for some thoughts on those questions.
Okay, so thanks, Christina, for the question. It's a very good question and a really difficult question. How much time do you have in the evening to let me give you a really broad answer? Honestly, I've been thinking a lot about this problem. And if I have a crystal clear solution, I will publish it immediately. Yeah. What my findings so far were, it is unrealistic at the moment, I think, to get a solution in the European Union that every country takes a quota of refugees. A certain
quota. I haven't washed your hair.
Come
on. Molly, I think you need to put your mute on. A colleague who I think is counterbalancing, as we all are these days, family responsibilities.
I know the problem very well. I have completely understanding for this. We won't have a European Union solution here in managing a distribution, but perhaps what we could do, because we also have the problem in Germany, we have really right-wing tendencies here, even if Germany did a quite good job in managing the whole refugee question. We should go to the countries and getting the people to our country. I will give you an example. The state of Baden-Württemberg in Germany did a very good job in getting Yazidi women from Iraq to Germany. And these were really women that were tortured and everything. I don't want to mention this more precisely, from the Islamic State. And they came here and they get immediately the psychiatric treatment, all the things they needed. And I think this was a better job in taking vulnerable groups that really had not the possibility to come here. Because often I think at the moment we have a little bit a struggle of life policy here in the European Union, a Darwinistic approach. Only the strongest can really manage to come here. Yeah? If you are a child, if you are a mistreated man or woman and you don't have the power to come here, we'll stay in your country and suffer. So we don't really get always the people who suffer the most to our countries here and treat them the right way. So I think one solution would be to get there and really to look after the people who needs our asylum the most, because then you have two things. I think you really get the population in the countries to respect that these people need our help here, and you prevent them from crossing the Mediterranean Sea, because at the moment, I think we all remember the horrifying picture of Alan Kurdi. Yeah, but if we really want to stop something like this, we have to stop that people are forced to come over the Mediterranean Sea. So we have a solution to get to them, that they come here. And that's not the struggle of life solution, who has the money and the power to come here. I don't want to say that all the people that are here don't need our help, but I think there are also people over there left behind with psychiatric problems. We don't get them here. So I think there we have to change a thing. And then I think perhaps we can also have a better argumentation around right-wing populists, that we are doing really here a human rights-based approach. That's my suggestion for the moment.
Yes. To add to that, I agree with that 100%. To add to that, there have been two other ideas, I think, floating around in the debate. I haven't followed it that closely. But one is that Europe should be more flexible, the European Union and its member states, in allowing legal migration under certain conditions. Because the more predictable that process becomes, the less urgency there may be for some categories of people to try and come to Europe. Now, that is not talking about the urgent cases that Daniela mentioned. It's talking about other people who might wish to come. But that type of approach strikes me as a sensible element of a much wider set of policy solutions, or answers rather. Another important ingredient is helping countries to stabilize and respect human rights at home. In other words, trying to prevent push factors that will lead to migration in the future. From that perspective, I am currently quite worried about what I see happening in different Sahel countries, where we see a conflagration of the effects of drought, tensions between farmers and nomadic tribesmen, and Islamist radicalization that feeds on the insecurity of people that do not get enough support from their own state, because the state is either incapable of providing that support or run by a kleptocracy. So extending aid to the Sahel countries to strengthen human rights, to improve living conditions, and to create more livelihood for people there is part of the answer to prevent these push factors. But there are no simple solutions. Then the question about quickly about the question of hate speech. Hate speech is a horrible thing, and it should be tackled forthright and directly through speech. Politicians and opinion leaders should be much more forthright and outrageous to call out people engaging in hate speech. It's not happening sufficiently because centrist politicians are afraid of losing vote to the right wing. So they remain silent when they should be speaking out. We see that in all European countries, and it's deeply worrying. What is the role of counterterrorism agencies? It is to prevent violent attacks. So that's where we should draw, in my opinion, the line. This is what the European Court of Human Rights has ruled in 2001 and 2015, views that cannot be read as incitement to violence or as liable to incite violence should be covered by freedom of expression. I think that is a sensible criterion.
Thank you very much. We have a further thought on migration. I can see that those remarks of yours, Daniela, have really inspired a lot of thinking in our audience. Charlotte from the LSE asks, with the EU's border approach being based on securitization frameworks, do you think it is possible to retroactively build in EU-wide asylum policies addressing irregular border crossings rather than member states individually having their own asylum processes? So I think a question wanting to juxtapose national interest, national security with EU-wide security and potentially rights.
Yes, thanks, Charlotte, for again a very difficult question, a very good question. At the moment, I think, as I already outlined in my lecture, I think we are really not having an asylum policy based on human rights. We are having insecurity policies based on blocking refugees out of the European Union. I think that's a status quo at the moment, even if politicians might explain this to you in another way, but to be honest, this is the way. There should be a solution at the borders, but at the moment I think the steps are we are closing our borders. So closing our borders, the Greeks against Turkey. So if we have here on the national, this is the thing. We should work on this. We should work on an asylum that's including everything, because at the moment, for example, Germany profited a lot that we are in the middle of the European Union, so that every refugee that would come to us was already in another state. So we could push them back and say, sorry, you can't come to us because you were first registered in Greece, in Austria, in Italy, you name it. So I think this is really an unjust balance at the moment. And there has Germany a certain role to play in giving up the system, because for us, it's quite comfortable. We can say, okay, we take them or we don't take them, because this is the legal system. So we first have to change the legal system, the Dublin system, to get to a better solution. And also that the pressure is not only on Italy and Greece, because, for example, Italy has also a problem with populists, because we left them completely alone with all the problems at the Mediterranean Sea. So we need I think, a program here. So you're completely right. But we are not right at this moment in the position to do this. And so I want to grab the idea of peace from counterterrorism, because he was completely right when he said it's also up to the civil society. I think if we really want to change here, we're at the moment in closing our borders. So if we really would like to campaign for an asylum system, I think this won't come at the moment from the politician side. This should come from the civil society side. If we really would like to have a chance here, I think there should be a strong approach from this side. Otherwise, I won't see a realistic approach, to be honest.
A related question, picking up some of your comments around migration, but also linking them up with your thoughts on social media. Vlad, who is a junior researcher, is raising the issue of disinformation campaigns that benefit far-right and populist actors and may well, you know, be made against those actors who might perhaps indeed be rather more generous towards questions around migration and refugees and more inclined to view them from a rights perspective rather than from a security perspective. Again, the question is, how should we respond to this? What can governments do, you know, in such situations? And on this, Guise, you may well, I think, perhaps like to come in too, and some of your experiences, perhaps disinformation and counterterrorism clearly is another relevant crossover.
That's a huge additional can of worms. But on this particular point of how to counteract dehumanization, first of all, I would very much agree with Daniela that it's not just something that one should look at governments to respond to. This is something where civil society can play a really important role. And I've seen lots of local communities and civil society organizations doing extraordinary good work at local level, accommodating refugees and asylum seekers and building bridges with people living in the same neighborhood. Because that is ultimately the answer. The answer to dehumanization is rehumanization. Making human beings not an anonymous force that is about to swamp our country, but individuals, young women, old men, you name it, who have a story to tell. And telling these stories to our local communities and reaching out to the stories that local communities have to tell. The moment people start talking to each other, they stop shouting at each other. So I think that is a crucial ingredient of the answer. And that is something that government should be encouraging. Prime ministers should dare to call a human being, and not just one exemplar of this force about to swamp us.
And if I come also back to the question of counter propaganda from Vlad, I think there was a good thing last week happening. I don't know if it was in the newspapers in Great Britain, in the newspapers of Germany, it was not that widely discussed. You all know we are waiting for the elections in the United States, and normally in October, we are all waiting for the October surprise. Last time it were the emails of Hillary Clinton, and last week they tried with new emails of Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, and they tried to with emails to prove that he has had illegal affairs in Ukraine. And I think this was a good thing that Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube worked together and really blocked even Ivanka Trump's account for a while, that this all these lies couldn't be published anymore. So there are things we can do against this. We don't have to get out of this event completely depressed and say, oh no, all this propaganda and all this thing and the hate crime will destroy us. There are things to do. And I think a good thing is that Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube have understood or are starting to understand that they have to do something, even Facebook, because he is not really known that he is really likes to protect human rights, the founder of Facebook. But I think there is a change in thinking about this so that there can something be done. And I already explained to you, we try in Germany that we like to tell to the tech firms, you have to do something. So the state is already trying to give a legal setting that something should be done. And there are also on the social society level, for example, initiatives to try to make in counter propaganda and counter narrative. I try to teach in my lectures my students how to file a claim against Facebook, against Twitter, if they detect hate crime there, and give it to the police station or to the law. So I already had a conversation, because I'm teaching in Düsseldorf, with one of the policemen in Düsseldorf, said, we have now a lot of more claims against hate speech here in Düsseldorf. I don't know why. And I said, yeah, finally, we can change here something. So I think it's really also something of everybody of us. If we make a commentary, for example, if we use the commentary function and doing a counter commentary, or if we're going to the police and file a claim and say, that's illegal what's happening here, do something against this. So this is a huge task for the state, for the business companies, and for every one of us. And then we can really do something against all these propaganda machines.
Yes, but I mean, on that point, I would add as well, you know, this whole kind of development of social media, and clearly it's got a double edge, but part of it is a positive one, because of course NGOs as well can use it to try and help spread more positive messages as indeed can all of us. And I think certainly what's very implicit in both of your comments, and I'll say it again, but perhaps in a slightly different way, really, if we're going to resist this and refuse, as Gies has said we should do, which I strongly agree with, to assume that we have to, you know, always have this combination of national security there, rather say, no, we don't, is of course to push back and say there's no threat here. You know, this isn't a security issue. Not everything is about security. And indeed, you know, at the same token, to think about our social responsibilities as well. So not just the rights as the trump, but rather the social responsibility, the responsibility, the duty that comes with it. And I think, again, Daniela, you know, invite some thoughts from you on this. One of the things that struck me very much over the last few months with COVID, it's a kind of unfolding scenario in our midst, is this interesting kind of dichotomy in language between those who will, for instance, look at the face mask and see it as an infringement of rights, you know, recasting the problem as my right to my own autonomy versus my responsibility, my social responsibility to help protect the health of others. And that seems to be a kind of curious dynamic in some sense around all of these issues as well. And then again, I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on some of these questions too.
That's what I call the fundamental rights shopping at the moment. Yeah, I completely don't understand if we have this pandemic crisis. I'm 44 years old, so this is in my lifetime the biggest crisis I'm facing at the moment, because all the other crises were far away. Yeah, I was comfortable in Germany looking at the crisis. I was horrified, but I was never hurt by this by myself. So now everyone in every country all around the world is infected, has to deal with this whole new situation. And I'm completely understand that's a frightening situation. But for example, I'm living here in the middle of the town of Münster. Every Saturday, there's a huge demonstration against all the corona initiatives and saying masks are exactly what you described, Jennifer. They are forbidding us that free speech and everything. And I think you're free speech right at this moment. How can you say you're not allowed to talk openly if you're doing this right at the moment and saying the masks are forbidding us? So it's a little bit of craziness coming out here. And I think this is also a little bit the problem of the internet. If everyone has the possibility to distribute their own opinion, that's a great thing. Don't get me wrong, especially for human rights organizations, for individuals, it's a good thing. But there's no filter anymore. So the crowd intelligence is something sometimes more proud than intelligence, yeah? And that's a problem with COVID-19. They will always find people who say this is a big lie, and then we will think people, oh, it's not necessary. I don't know anybody who has already had COVID-19. They are against my own laws. And then they're thinking, against which law? And then they're going back to the basics. Ah, yeah, I remember there were the fundamental rights. They're against my fundamental rights. They're against the state. They're against the same. I think it's a little bit hysteric. We have to come down a little bit to approach the problems more calm, more silently, and stop with this human rights shopping, to take a human rights, take it for my own target, what I have, and say, now I'm fighting for human rights. This has nothing to do with human rights defending. There are people around the world who are doing a great job, but not in Germany, for example, in this anti-COVID-19 demonstrations.
There is, in fact, a risk that free speech as an issue is being hijacked by people who are trying actually to undermine free speech. And the only way
to... It's part of the problem as well, isn't it? I mean, it's
absolutely. That is a classic populist tactic, but it is now being wielded by thugs on the street. And it's happening under our eyes. We can see it. I'm always wary of parallels with history because it's always easy to suggest a parallel where it isn't there, but it is inevitable if we look at thugs on the street and their behavior today, not to think about what happened in the 1930s in Europe. And anyone with an ounce of historic understanding will understand that what happened then was that people said, it can't be that bad. I mean, these people are just slightly off there, slightly bonkers, but things will calm down. But they didn't. Do not let this slide. So I hope that the people taking part in this debate will also assume a little bit of personal responsibility. We can push back on the internet by writing back. If we detect anti-Semitic messages on the internet, we can react. We can complain to the authorities, we can complain to Facebook, we can take action. We should not stay silent. Final point about Facebook, there is some discussion now on the other side of the Atlantic to regulate Facebook. I think that is actually potentially very, very, very important discussion. Facebook and Google have become so powerful that they are more powerful than democratically elected governments in regulating and steering how we speak and listen to each other. That can't be right in a democracy. Public authorities must claw back some kind of framing within which these organizations will have to operate. And that means they also have to become more accountable. When Daniela says, I'm trying to encourage my students to complain and to write letters to Twitter and Facebook, I would very much applaud that. But I would be even happier if Facebook and Twitter would allow external researchers access to the way they deal with these complaints, because that is a black box. They hide behind their commercial secrets not to allow us as citizens a view on how they make the selection into what is acceptable and what is not. Public authorities need to claw back, because we cannot let this debate slide.
And we also have to be precise in the categories. If somebody is insulting me, it's an insult. It's not freedom of opinion. An insult is an insult. Yeah. So we also have to be very precise. And as you said, they are hiding behind freedom of opinion, but it's not freedom of opinion to insult somebody. As we've seen from Donald Trump, he's insulting people. This has nothing to do with freedom of opinion. It's easy to take Trump for an example because every sentence you can take. But I mean also, yeah, it's not an analyze, it's a fact. But also on the discussion on Facebook, everything, an insult is an insult, and it's not freedom of expression. And there we have to be very clear. If somebody is insulting us and say, why are you, don't get angry, I'm just taking advantage of my freedom of expression. No, this has nothing to do with freedom of expression. It's an insult. And if we are precise here, if we are more, we are forcing them to go back in the box.
So conflation is a problem, both for what is and is not security and what is not human rights. In that both sense, we need to be wary, I think is what you're saying. Keith, you wanted to come in.
I was just wondering, we've touched upon, I think, four of the five areas that Daniela so eloquently outlined in her introduction, but we haven't really spoken yet about the export of surveillance technology a great deal yet. And I think that's a very important theme, because it goes to the heart of credibility of Western countries. If on the one hand we claim to be defending human rights and we want Facebook to behave, we should not be exporting surveillance technology that can be abused to suppress human rights. Now, it's not as easy as that, of course, because that same surveillance technology can be used for perfectly legitimate objectives. So how can we draw the line? How can human rights criteria be built in to that export technology legislation, do you think?
In Germany, we have already implemented human rights issues in the legislation. But to be honest, I've formerly worked in the German Chancellery, exactly in the export section, and I observed how it's dealt. And let me be diplomatic here. Yeah? It's dealt the German way. If something is written down and somebody says to us, we won't just use it for this use, we are content with it. So you can do it the easy way and get, okay, I have a formula here. Please write down that you will just use it for peaceful target and not misuse it. So at the moment, I'm a little bit exaggerating, but we are quite content in Germany with it and saying to everyone, hey, we're doing a good export policy here. If we have a paper written down that it's just for peaceful objectives, it's fine for us. So there has to be a control for the control of export services, I think. For example, in Germany, it's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Economics. They're coming together and discussing the cases of a company who likes, for example, to export guns or whatever to Iran, Iraq, you can imagine, whatever, or to Saudi Arabia. And they're discussing, what's the human rights situation there, what we can do. So sometimes the process of human rights is there to have a label. We are respecting human rights, but in the end, you're not respecting human rights. If you think about where German weapons were found in which conflicts, it doesn't work that well. So, yeah, it's the question, if you ask the companies, we are part of the economy. If you're doing laws like this, we can't work anymore. We're failing. We won't make money anymore. This is bad for the economy. These are the simple argumentations. But you have installed human rights standards in the legislation. And if it's just for the purpose that the opposition has a tool to control the government where the exports are going. And I think this is absolutely necessary, even if I have described to you now quite cynically, that it's not working. But you have to write it down. But in the end, if it's working, what is Saudi Arabia doing with the surveillance system or China? China's able to construct it itself. They don't need other goods anymore. But you have installed it in the legislation to have a tool for the opposition, for civil society. What's going on here is going wrong. That's, I think, one of the tools, even if not the perfect tool, to be realistic. What do you think?
It's not my field, unfortunately. I know there's been discussion about amending the EU regulation on this point for many years between the European Parliament and the Council of Ministers. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Germany was one of the countries that was reticent in accepting the European Parliament's push for higher human rights standards. But I may be wrong on that point, so I apologise. But I also think this subject is under-researched. I do not come across a great deal of academic research, comparative academic research, empirical research, where researchers from France, Germany, the UK, the Netherlands, and other countries actually investigate their national policy, actually trigger their national ministries to become more transparent. I think academics could do a lot more to create that degree of transparency and concerted European research into this area. So if there are any students taking part in this discussion who are still looking for term paper subjects, this is actually a very, very valid one.
That's true.
Hot tip for everybody out there.
There we are. You heard it here first.
Well, I think we're probably reaching that point in our conversation where it's perhaps time to invite Daniela for final kind of thoughts and reflections to share with us, and Gies yourself as well. Is there any kind of headline points, Daniela, you would we'd really like to come back to and emphasize?
I hope what we can grasp from this event, that security politics and human rights are not excluded, they are linked to each other, that we have to think both in a parallel thing, that perhaps my two questions, please keep them in mind in your lectures. Are the measures itself violating human rights? Have they an aim to protect human rights? That with these questions, you can link security politics and human rights, because you can't install security via the violation of human rights. That's a big topic. I know in political reality, it's not always that easy, but we are here on the academic approach, on the critical approach, and we can look from this critical perspective and put our finger in the wound and say, no, that's not the way it should be. If it's hate speech, if it's especially migration, we have a huge problem here. We have a huge work. I could see it from the question of the students here. We have the surveillance technology. We have counterterrorism. So there are a lot of fields, and there would be even a lot more topics we could discuss about this. But there's the link between security politics and human rights politics, and it should be thought together. Please keep this in mind also in your lectures and also later on in your professional life.
Yes.
I think that's much too good a conclusion for me to add anything to. I very much agree with that. I hope we have managed in this last hour to touch upon a few aspects of this broad question of the false dichotomy between security and liberty. The question is not either or, but how we can combine the two in a sensible way based on our international human rights. It's possible, but it's hard work. My only point would be that it is much harder work than we see reflected in the discussion in mainstream media. There's a lot going on, from the question of encryption. Should security and intelligence services gain access to encrypted messages to fight terrorism? How will that affect the rights of the opposition in Turkey? To name just one example, two questions to do with freedom of speech and how far one should be able to go. These are fundamental questions of citizenship. And I'm delighted that the LSE, with its focus on rigid academics, but also an eye on practice, has decided to put this on the agenda. I hope it will lead to more comparative research at European level.
Well, I mean, it's my time now really to thank you both, and thank you for opening up what's been an extremely rich and wide-ranging conversation. I'm sure the students and the others in the audience listening tonight will take away from it a great appreciation for indeed how relevant this question is across so many different policy areas. And obviously it's not a narrow vision of security here, it's quite a far-reaching one. And indeed equally, that sensibility of human rights really should be the cornerstone of our governance and of our societies, however we want to approach them. So I think these have been very important conversations to have had. LSE, of course, according to Beatrice and Sydney Webb, exists for the betterment of society. And I think in our conversation, we've tried to come back to that great tradition. So really, final big thank you from me, not only from myself, but also I think to everybody listening. Panel has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Daniela and Gies, for taking part and for sharing your thoughts with us. And indeed, thank you to the audience for asking their questions and for being here with us tonight. So thank you, everyone. I'm going to be ending in a moment our call. And obviously, we look forward to having other events of this kind in the future. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Bye. Thank you, Jennifer Gies.